This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
nobody can understand why anybody would believe that he would get rich by selling some other human body parts.
That's Heather Wick Ntaba, who heads a committee to fight abuse of people with albinism after a priest was arrested in Malawi in connection with the murder of a young albino man. Details coming up.
Also, the United Arab Emirates has announced it will cut military training to over 2,000 Somali forces. And in Washington, an 11-person panel at the International Monetary Fund's spring meetings is tackling the issue of gender-based violence.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story, the Islamic Movement of Nigeria demonstrated again today in Abuja. A rally by the group on Monday descended into violence, leading to dozens of arrests and injuries. The IMN is demanding the release of its leader, who has been in state custody since a deadly military crackdown on the group more than 2 years ago. Chika Adua has more on the story from VOA's regional bureau in Dakar.
Members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, or IMN, have been gathering in the Nigerian capital every day since mid-January to protest. Every day, they repeat the same chant. They're calling for the release of the Shiite cleric Ibrahim Zakzaki, the founder and leader of the IMN. He and his wife have been detained since December 2015. Authorities have refused to comply with the 2016 court order to release them. IMN spokesman Ibrahim Musa told VOA that Zakzaki had a minor stroke and is experiencing eye problems. He said the government has denied Zakzaki's request to travel abroad for medical treatment.
He's suffering a lot in amputation, so I believe that the federal government is just buying time, probably waiting for him to die in detention. And that is why, apart from the legal paths we have taken, we resorted to protest so that at least our voice can be heard by the world.
The Nigerian government has repeatedly said that IMN breaks laws and incites unrest. Police have shut down IMN rallies this week. A protester shared cell phone footage he shot Monday with VOA. The video shows police officers on horseback. Some of the officers grab the protesters by their arms. Protesters throw stones at armored tanks. 32-year-old Abdullahi Musa told us what he saw. He's a member of IMN.
They throw much tear gas and water cannons and lesser unused live bullets on us, and they shoot a lot of people. Yesterday, myself, I was injured on my knee. They hit me with a stick. I have many, like three friends that were seriously injured by gunshots.
Nigerian police have not responded to accusations that officers used live bullets. In a statement Monday, police said at least 115 people were arrested and 22 officers injured. Amnesty International has been investigating the government's response to IMN since 2013. Isa Sanusi, the media officer for Amnesty's Nigeria office, spoke to VOA.
We call on the government to allow them their right to lawful protest and lawful assembly and freedom of expression so that they can be able to voice their grievances, voice their anger. They have been peaceful and there have never been a threat. We see no reason why the government would actually resort to the kind of excessive use of force as displayed in Abuja in the last days.
Nigeria's Shiite minority says it has faced repression for decades, something IMN attributes to the centuries-old rift between Shiite and Sunni Muslims. The IMN does not recognize the authority of the federal government. Some Nigerian states have banned the IMN, describing its members as extremist and insurgents. Six out of nine of Zakzaki's children have been killed in clashes with security forces in the past 20 years. In December 2015, soldiers attacked IMN's headquarters in the city of Zaria in northern Nigeria. More than 300 IMN supporters were killed. A Nigerian Commission of Inquiry investigated the incident and said it found evidence of mass graves in Zaria as well as the use of excessive force by the military. The spokesman for the IMN tells VOA the group will continue to demonstrate until Zakzaki is released. Chika Odua for VOA News in Dakar.
Thank you, Chika. Nigeria's Senate was brought to a halt today after armed men stole a ceremonial mace in what legislators called an act of treason. The mace is a symbol of power, and the Senate cannot pass legislation or make other decisions without its presence. The Senate later resumed its session, although it was not clear if officials had recovered the mace or found a backup. A senator who recently was suspended has been accused of leading the thieves. The Senate issued a statement saying the theft was aimed at overthrowing the legislature. On social media, Nigerians expressed embarrassment that the mace, which is more than a meter long, could be snatched in the middle of a Senate session.
Deteriorating relations between Somalia and the United Arab Emirates may be harming Mogadishu's military and also its humanitarian fight against terrorism. The United Arab Emirates has announced it will cut military training to over 2,000 Somali forces. It has also called Sheikh Zayed. It has also closed Sheikh Zayed Hospital. The facility, based in the capital, provides free medical service to 9,000 people per month. The move comes as the government continues its fight against al-Shabaab terrorists. They reportedly staged a roadside attack this week outside the town of Balad near the Kenyan border. Joining us now in studio is our colleague Harun Manouf from our VOA Somali service. Welcome, Harun.
Thank you very much.
So what can you tell us about the deteriorating relations between the United Arab Emirates and Somalia?
Well, the most recent controversial issue was related to the interception of an airline carrying three bags containing about $10 million. The United Arab Emirates was saying the money was for the Somali soldiers, but the Somali government, which was in a political turmoil at the time, thought that the money might be used internally to bribe politicians and destabilize the political situation of the country. So they confiscated the money and said they're going to investigate. That angered the United Arab Emirates. But this goes back to last year when United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia cut ties with Qatar, and they asked other Arab countries, including Somalia and others, to do the same. But Somalia said, no, we are weak, but we want to make our own decisions, who we're going to have relations and who we're not going to have any relations with. And then this was followed by the United Arab Emirates agreement with the breakaway Republic of Somaliland to set up a military base in Berbera, and also to have concession for the Berbera border. This is a 30 years long concession. Somali government said United Arab Emirates has done this without our knowledge. So they took that as a violation of the territorial integrity of Somalia, because, as you know, Somaliland has not yet been recognized, but Somaliland believes that it can deal unilaterally with other countries. So this was the background to the recent conflict.
So, Harun, if the United Arab Emirates withdraws military and humanitarian support, can Somalia find alternative sources of funding?
Somalia is going to struggle financially to cover the costs of its military. There is not very strong source of income for the Somali government. It relies on donations and support from international countries. They realize that. But what they're saying is that we're not going to jeopardize and compromise our integrity just because we wanted the salaries of several hundred. Somali government thinks that the number of troops are about several hundred troops. So they're going to say we're not compromise, we're not going to accept donations from any country at the expense of our territorial integrity. So this political standoff could continue and deteriorate. But last night we have learned that the president of Somalia has spoken to the president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. They did not announce it officially, but according to our sources, the Somali government is asking Egypt to mediate or at least play a role in de-escalating the situation.
And while you're here, what's the latest on the fighting between government forces and Al-Shabaab, especially around the Golole and the Balad areas?
This is a new sustained attack Al-Shabaab has been carrying out against government and AMISOM troops on this main highway that leaves Mogadishu to the central regions. They have already succeeded in cutting off the main road from Mogadishu to the western regions. So they want to do the same in order to cripple and attack the supply lines for the Somali National Army and for AMISOM. And they have attacked Burundian forces last month on this same area, killing about 17 AMISOM soldiers. So that was a massive setback for the peacekeepers. So they want to make this road completely impassable so that they jeopardize and cripple the supply lines.
Thank you, Haroon. That was Haroon Maruf from our VOA Somali service with an update on the situation in Somalia.
Police in Malawi have arrested a Catholic priest in connection with the recent abduction and murder of a 22-year-old man with albinism. 2 weeks ago, police arrested other suspects, among them a police officer and a medical officer. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
National Police spokesperson James Gadadzera says Father Thomas Mahosha of Mulombozi Parish in southern Malawi has become the 12th person to be arrested in connection with the murder. They are all accused of killing McDonald Masambuga 2 weeks ago. His legs and some bones had been taken from his body. Gadadzera says Mahosha was arrested after other suspects mentioned him as one of masterminds of the murder. All the suspects are yet to be charged, and investigations into the matter continues. Albino people who lack pigment in their skin have faced attacks because of false beliefs that their body parts have powers to bring good luck and wealth. Overstone Kondowe is the president of Association of People with Albinism in Malawi. He says the arrest of the priest is a major breakthrough in ending the attacks. But he says the government needs a serious commitment to end the attacks.
We are saying like that because these cases were also in other countries like Kenya and Tanzania. But because of good leadership and the commitment of these leaders, not only commitment by statement, but committing resources from government coffers to the action plan on albinism, that has led to the changes in the two countries mentioned.
Police records show more than 130 albinos have been injured since the attacks started in 2013. At least 20 people have been killed. Heather Wigintaba heads a committee tasked to fight abuse of people with albinism in Malawi. He says there is need for multi-sector approach to end the attacks.
We are trying our best to uncover this. That's why we are appealing to everybody. There are policemen, there are you, people in the media. As you can see, even close relatives, sometimes it's been uncles or fathers who have sold their own children. This is a tragedy. You know, why? Why would anybody do that?
However, Ntaba says the government is shocked with the status of people arrested in connections to the attacks.
We are very shocked, of course, but obviously these things, as I said, are deep in some people's beliefs. Nobody can understand why anybody would believe that he would get rich by selling some other human body parts, you know, in this case from persons with albinism. It makes absolutely no sense at all.
The suspect, Father Mahosha, has been suspended from his church duties, awaiting conclusion of the case. The bishop of the Diocese of Zomba, the Right Reverend George Desmond Dambala, said the church is shocked and ashamed that a priest is linked to albino killings. The church has offered to assist the police in their investigations into the matter. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
20 past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The Ugandan government has confirmed that it will receive Eritrean and Sudanese refugees being deported from Israel. Currently, there are over 30,000 from both countries who are in Israel illegally. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
Despite numerous denials of a deportation deal to take migrants expelled from Israel, Kampala has finally announced it is willing to take on some 500 Eritreans and Sudanese from the Jewish state. In January, Israeli authorities gave the African asylum seekers a 90-day ultimatum to leave their country, go to another, or face jail sentences. Musa Echweru is Uganda's state minister for disaster preparedness and refugees. He confirms Uganda is ready to take in the deportees.
Because of the understanding that the country of Uganda and the state of Israel have very fraternal relations, Uganda said we have no objection. In any case, we have an open door policy for refugee management. And 500 will not be too much, given what we have already accepted from the neighboring countries. Eritreans and South Sudanese should not be a surprise here, because we have already close to about 30,000 Eritreans here. So bring about maybe 200 or 300 of them to join their families here will not be something out of the ordinary.
He says the refugees will either be taken to refugee settlements or left to stay in Kampala and other towns, as urban refugees are free to set up their own income-generating projects.
There are a number of them already in Kampala here who are doing businesses, but we recognize them as our refugees and they have been documented by us. So we will assess them again on a case-by-case basis. Those who might want to do business in Kampala, Jinja, Soroti or wherever, we can facilitate them to do that if they have the capacity. Those who are unable and they want to go and maybe join their colleagues, because Eritreans are mainly in Hoima. There are some Eritreans in Naki Valley in western Uganda. We shall see if we can link them up with their loved ones.
Some Ugandan politicians are skeptical over the agreement between Uganda and Israel, wondering why it has been kept a secret for long. Winnie Kiza is the leader of Uganda's opposition in parliament.
They did not follow the normal channels other refugees have been following. So under what criteria are they being held here?
Earlier media reports suggested that Uganda and Israel cut a secret high-level deal in which it would accept refugees in return for arms, military training and other aid from Israel. However, Minister Echweru denies any material exchange involved in the deportation deal.
Already we have 1.4 million refugees here in Uganda. We have not been paid a cent. In fact, it is us spending our limited resources to make sure that we make them have a second home here in Uganda. So there is no payment attached to this. It is purely humanitarian.
This is the first time that a Ugandan government official has openly acknowledged a plan to host African asylum seekers who are forcibly thrown out of Israel. But there is information published by the Israel media indicating that 1,749 migrants have been deported to Uganda since 2015. According to the publications, 485 migrants were deported in 2015, 506 in 2016, 630 in 2017, and 128 to date in 2018. There are some 27,000 Eritreans and 7,700 Sudanese in Israel. Since Israel took over refugee status determination from UNHCR in 2009, only 10 Eritreans and 1 Sudanese have been recognized as refugees. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
In Washington, an 11-person panel at the International Monetary Fund's spring meetings is tackling the issue of gender-based violence. The panel has issued a two-pronged plan by the World Bank that sets up microfinance structures for women and partners with men to combat sexual violence. Ayen Dieng Bior reports from Washington.
The World Bank estimates 35% of women experience physical violence or sexual partner violence or non-partner sexual violence worldwide. World Bank Group President Jim Yong Kim told the audience at yesterday's panel discussion that 45 countries have no laws against domestic violence, while 59 countries don't have laws that address sexual harassment in the workplace.
Gender-based violence is a global pandemic. And when I, as an infectious disease doctor, say pandemic, I mean it. It is a problem that infiltrates every single society in the world. Every region, every income level.
The World Bank Group awarded a grant to 11 organizations who will study ways to prevent violence against women and girls. Three of the winners will study the issue in Rwanda, Kenya, and South Africa. Winner and panelist Anita Shankar, backed by Plan International Spain, has been working with refugees in Rwanda. Women there say they are vulnerable to attacks or harassment when they venture out of camps to collect firewood to cook meals. Shankar and her group provide clean cook stove and fuel to refugees, which vastly reduces their reliance on firewood, sometimes by as much as 80%. But Shankar says that may not be enough.
We also know that technology alone isn't enough. You need to have the behavior change. And so that's why we're very excited to have. We have a very unique behavioral intervention that's for both the women and their male partners, and that's really focused on having them understand how their thoughts and their beliefs and their emotions impact their behaviors.
In Kenya, Peg Bevin and her team at Sendakao are examining economic empowerment programs to reduce intimate partner violence. They came up with a transformative household methodology, which helps facilitate dialogue between men, women, girls, and boys in households and communities.
And really, they're uncovering the inequalities for themselves, and then they come up with the solutions. And we've even seen boys cry doing this because they realize how overburdened their mothers are. So we know that this tool brings very significant gender change in our program. What we don't know is the impact it's having on gender-based violence. And this is what we're working with the Global Women's Institute here in DC to find out.
A simple idea in South Africa is pairing school children with adults who supervise them as they walk to and from school. Zainab Isaac is one of the creators of this program called the Walking School Bus. She says the program creates local solutions for a global problem.
In KwaZulu-Natal, the province in which this work will be done, hundreds and thousands of children walk to school every day, 2 hours and longer. That journey is treacherous. There's lots of social harms. Children are vulnerable to rape, to murder, muggings and bullings. And I think that's not a problem just for KwaZulu-Natal, but the world over.
The Walking School Bus is just one of the programs the World Bank is using to put in place preventative measures and simple solutions to end gender-based violence against young girls and women. Ayen Deng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says he will seek his party's presidential ticket to contest elections in February 2019, ending months of speculation about his future. The future of 75-year-old Muhammadu Buhari on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. tuning to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.